This is Tape 6, Side 1 of The Impersonal Actor. The Primary Doings. There are certain exact ways in which we communicate. The doings are called just that because they are the things that we do to communicate. Defining them is a wonderful tool in understanding the nature of our most frequently employed methods of exchange. The things that we do are universal in human behavior, no matter race or nationality. We have a pretty good idea what someone is communicating to us in another language is about, even if we do not know exactly what that something is. In other words, we know right away that a Frenchman is outraged about something, even if we don't know what it is he's outraged about. We can always tell when someone in China is just talking about how something just is, that can't be changed, even if we aren't exactly sure what that something is. We know right away when we see a defiant Russian, though we may not at all know if his defiance is about bread in specific or life in general. We see two tribal Africans nodding when a third is describing something, and we know that they're communicating that they understand what the man is saying. We know when a mother in San Salvador makes that certain sound about unfortunate things beyond her control, as quickly as we recognize an Egyptian mother's sigh about how her new baby's cuteness is equally inescapable. These things are all universal human experiences, which we all share, which should tell us a lot about ourselves. Another way of saying it is that these things are the modes of communication, constructed, refined, cataloged in our common consciousness for millions of years, and thankfully, or we wouldn't have communication. Language is cultural. Communication is universal. So then, these universal things which we do to communicate, we call the doings. They are included in this course as a tool to aid you in better understanding human communication, and as such, will be the cornerstone of your new technique. So, now, the doings. To admit is probably the most common communication form. It's simply to speak of the truth of things as they exist. For example, if you were to ask me how I was doing, and I was hunky-dory and my line is fine, I would say I was fine. To say the line in this way is to include nothing other than the simplest truth of the matter. Now, that's not to say that one might not be required to admit to something phenomenal in its implications, such as if someone asked a condemned man if he knew he was to die in the morning, and his answer is, yes. This admit would more than likely include the implications of the impending truth coming out of his looking into his immediate future, but the response would be an admit. Admits account for a huge part of all acting. In reality, you'll find, generally speaking, about half of most writing consisting of admits, many of which are powerful little moments because they're in fact less than what would seem to be called for by the situation. Thus, there have been so many wonderful performances which were hailed as being underplayed or understated when in fact it was in the writing that a character responds with a simple testimony to the truth as he sees it, even before the most dire circumstances. Often, when we admit, we either actually or virtually shrug our shoulders in a natural communication that what we're referring to isn't supposed to be in any way wise or sage, but that somehow it has to be said anyway. Admitting is the least one can do and still communicate. And what is communicated is that the information riding on the communique is well known, widely accepted, and common knowledge, or will readily be all of these things to the listener. We naturally admit, in order to not insult people by making it seem like our thought is so much greater than their thought, simply that an idea has come through our brain first. To admit, then, is to tell it like it is, but without the force of supposed individual wisdom or knowledge. It's to respond to the question, are you a human being, with the communique, yes, I am. Ever heard someone say, oh, this is just narrative, as though the writer had put this in for the sake of the plot only and that there's no other way to do it than to ladle it out like so much soup? In acting, we're never acting facts. We're always communicating something about the facts. And that thing we're communicating is there for you to see in the writing. It's always there. Quite often, what is being communicated about those facts is that they're just the facts. That's how it is. That's how it goes. That's the way it is. You just heard four admits in a row. Important here, not to assume that your character thinks poorly about the way things are. Most characters who are merely referring to how things are not purporting any distaste for life as it goes. In fact, usually what's to be seen is a real acceptance of the situation. Remember objectivity. Often you'll find your character in a narrative monologue actually admitting quite objectively to how life goes because they know they can't change it all in one day, even if they wanted to. Be looking for where the writing has your character just admitting to something. If it's as inconsequential as what time it is while sunning on the beach, to the deepest implications of what time it is the night before one's scheduled execution. Both are admits, the former being a moment which includes few implications, the latter being a moment which includes all the implications in the world. Yet both are the least thing you can do and still communicate. And interestingly enough, when we finally do attest to our truest feelings and our most deeply held beliefs, it's done just exactly that way. Your character's most profound moments in drama or comedy are likely to be rather petite moments, often with a lot of irony. How do you know when your character is just admitting to something? Well, if there's a passionate exchange of issues going on and your character is in the midst of it, everything obviously hasn't been said. But you can look for the admits when all has been said, or when it all just goes without saying, or when there's nothing else to say. Like now. To lament. Laments are communiques about the degree to which things exist. Again, the degree to which things exist. One admits that they do exist, one laments to the degree to which they do. Wow, what a beautiful day! When said about the prettiest autumn day you've ever seen is a lament, a communication about how incredibly beautiful it is, which is to say that your character is not just communicating that it's a beautiful day, but the extent to which it is beautiful. Look at one of the first things we did as children to communicate about things we experienced. We pointed to the thing. Directly communicating about the thing, look at that thing, so that the thing we were beholding is what was exciting, rather than our feelings being excited, which is what we've come to believe is the essence of the experience. It's our world that's excited by the event. So that in reality, in life, a thing is joyous, or a thing is sad, or a thing is exciting, or a thing is frightening, or a thing is sweet, or a thing is lovely, or a thing is hateful, or a thing is whatever, but that thing is not us. So we are not really expressing our feelings when we communicate. We are responding to the existence of something outside of us, and the degree to which it exists, and the kind of response depends upon how we perceive the thing or the experience, which is then labeled as our feelings. Therefore, our feelings are actually a mirror to a thing perceived, reflecting the perceived essence of a thing, rather than a unique communique from within ourselves about the value of the thing beheld. If you are in a restaurant, say, and you bite into a bad burger and it tastes very nasty, those sounds you make aren't the feelings about the burger. They are the burger itself as you perceive it, aren't they? Everything you communicate at that moment is burger, not you at all. You are not that face you're making. That face you're making is the burger. That sound coming out of your mouth is not the sound of you. That sound is the sound of a bad burger, right? When a child looks at a thing and points and says, ooh, ooh, those oohs are not the child's feelings. Those oohs are the thing itself, or part of the thing itself, as perceived by the child. Coming to mind is how a story was recently related to me by a friend of mine about an airplane ride he experienced on a Hercules transport flown by the Peruvian Air Force, in which he and 40 other members of a botanical research expedition were airlifted out of a village. My friend described what it was like for 40 people to crawl over thousands of stacked crates of empty beer bottles to get amidships the aircraft, to sit on the floor next to one another in a space roughly the size of a small bedroom, to know panic and terror itself when the exposed hydraulics within the plane squealed and roared the flaps into position, and then when the plane went straight up in order to make it over the Andes. Look carefully, and you'll see how wonderful it is when we communicate about such things. We are not expressing our feelings about it. We are not reliving it. We are communicating something about the event itself in the exact way a child points and goes, ooh, ooh. When that pilot goes up at a particularly stiff angle right after takeoff, the sound you make is not your feelings. It is the force and action and implication of the event of defying gravity itself as you perceive it. What people communicate about things outside of them is the exact means by which we understand in great detail the motivations and history and worldview which brought about that current perception of the world. We will know the tree by its fruit. Let's say I could somehow cosmically communicate a rainbow to a group of people without spelling it out. The first may respond, "What a beautiful rainbow." A second, "It's just a red thing." Another, "What a wonderful shade of green." And yet another, "There's every color but violet." Each of these responses is about the rainbow, not expressions of the feelings of the respondent. Yet from each of these responses, we know volumes about the person or in drama, the character who voiced them. We know the first person can both perceive and appreciate rainbows. We know that the second not only doesn't perceive rainbows, but doesn't appreciate what is seen. We know the third doesn't perceive rainbows, but does appreciate what is seen. We know the last can perceive and appreciate rainbows, but in a limited way. And we know all of this not because they expressed their feelings, but because they were talking about a rainbow. As previously said, when we make known our true feelings, it's almost always in a way which includes that they are not special or important. They're just usually admitted to. When we lament for something, it's not only not necessarily sad, but the sky is the limit for expression because it is something outside of us which we are addressing. Call it life, call it destiny, call it God. We do not express our feelings as such because to do so is to imply that our personal feelings are more important than those of others, and they are not. The sun belongs to everyone, and so does feeling, emotion, thought, and being. What is truly profound is universal being, and that is what we express when we lament for something. To chide. To chide is to communicate disapproval over another's behavior in a way intended to extract a price. It is to punish, to chastise. You'll see it used very rarely in the work of the greats because they know that to be heard, one must first do no harm. And most lead characters and lead actors want to be heard. This is one of those things in acting which separates the men and women from the boys and the girls, for the accomplished actor will rarely substitute a chide for what is actually a challenge or a loving yell. It is widely thought in acting that argument scenes and even love scenes should often contain a lot of chiding, when in fact any chiding, if it is actually written in the scene, will usually occur in the end of the scene when all possible solutions will have run out or for very short moments. One cannot long listen to actual chiding without needing to physically leave because it's so hurtful to the ear. You will be looking for chiding in a scene where there's been a passionate exchange with no unity obtained, or after an avoidance of that exchange, and where there's nothing left but hurting as a means to communicate. And that very rarely occurs more than a few times in any one piece of material. If you find yourself punishing other characters a lot, it would be well to look for the cause. While it is true that chiding can be found in scenes between family members in writing, it's most effective when served up easily and effortlessly, as between people who know one another's weaknesses. You'll also find chiding far more abundant in comedy than in drama, and will be in the writing when you least expect it, as, for example, in response to when someone's trying to be nice to you. To convince. You will look for this doing only when your character, against his normal good judgment, thinks that the other characters will not believe what he has to say, and that it's important for them to believe him. So he convinces them that something is the way he says it is. It's a rare doing because in life, anyone who convinces a lot gives the rest of us the impression that he doubts his own contentions. Look for this moment only when it's the last resort to having other characters believe what your character has to say. Remember how Vivian Leigh said, "As God is my witness, I'll never be hungry again," in Gone with the Wind? Or how Gregory Peck said, "He rises," regarding the white whale in Moby Dick? Or how Betty Davis said, "Fasten your seatbelts, we're in for a bumpy night," to her company in All About Eve? Or how Clint Eastwood said to the punk, "Go ahead, make my day," in Sudden Impact? To defy. This is a wonderful human communication, and you'll usually find it when your character is coming up against overwhelming odds, or when he's leading a group of people who are up against overwhelming odds. When your character defies, he challenges the behavior of the others standing against him, daring that behavior to continue. Or when he's stirring up others under him to meet a challenge, in which case he defies the odds against them. It is most noble and very powerful when it's done without any anger, bitterness, or resentment. For the power of the Defy raises the stakes to a level far surpassing these things, lifting the issues to those of righteousness. Come on, then, do your worst. Or just plain, I dare you. Remember how Cher in Moonstruck slapped Nicolas Cage twice and yelled, snap out of it, after he declared his love to her? To bawl out is to yell with love at somebody. One can even perceive that any possible harm is directed over the head of the recipient without any intention of damage. It's used by someone who holds himself in a position of authority to get the attention of those he holds to have gone too far, and again is mostly used as a last resort or as a joke about relentless conditions. Quite often there's much humor included, which comes from having disbelief that one is required to yell at all. To encourage is to cheer someone on or to buck someone up. The greats really know how to do this one well. You'll find it in the writing when another character is on the verge of or in need of taking a risk. So often, interestingly enough, this moment is acted punishingly, as though that would push someone into taking a chance, rather than pushing them away, which is what really happens. Often this is a tough love moment, not a weak thing. It comes from the gut, but it is not a reproof, but a cheering on of the other character. Sometimes with great force and passion, but it must never cross the line into chiding, for at that moment the belief factor will be lost, and this is why. If you're trying to get another character to do what is good for him, for everybody, and you punish him into it, then immediately it appears that the reason you pushed him into it is only for your own benefit and not for his. At that moment, we care nothing for your character and less for the other character for being moved by chastisement. If, however, your character is emboldening the other, then that will always be perceived as an act which is done for the other character and not solely for yourself, so that your character is ennobled and the other character is deemed intelligent for having been moved to action by your luminescence and vigor and not by your threats. To make something a good idea is another form of encouragement, but is a petite encouragement. Sometimes, as in the case of asking for a small favor, like, hand me that pen. We include a tiny apology for intruding on another's space. But usually a good idea is just that, a modest encouragement to do something, like, no, after you. The show doings. In life, we often put on little shows. Why? For the fun of it, for the communication of it, for the variety, for the entertainment of others, for a joke, and for clarity, for creativity. The following are called the show doings, because in communicating them, we make subtle and sometimes not so subtle shows in order to get our point across. They are to show surprise, as in, well, hi. To show understanding. You mean I talk too much. To show disdain or scorn. Oh, please. To show anger. What? To show delight.
Yes!
These communications may or may not correspond to the character's actual condition, feelings, or state of mind. For example, you can show anger to a rowdy while in no wise feeling that way preponderantly. I can show that I understand a mathematical formula and not have the faintest idea which end is up. I can show delight that the birthday present is just what I always wanted, even when it isn't. I can show disdain in public for food that I love, and I can show surprise for seeing someone I well expected to see. And none of these makes anyone a fraud or a liar, but rather quite human. The doings will be of enormous value to you as a tool for analyzing the script and the communiques you're asked to make. Learn them, and they will teach you. This is the end of Tape 6, Side 1 of The Impersonal Actor. We'll continue our discussions on Side 2.